You know, Hal, and we haven't seen you in a while, but I've always had a challenge getting you to talk a little bit about your service in the military that led you to receive the nation's highest medal, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Would you be kind enough to share with our audience what took place in your life in the military?
Well, I was with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, which was the only regimental cavalry in Vietnam, and I served under then Colonel George S. Patton, who was the son of the World War II Patton.
Really? I did not know that. He's the son of General Patton. Wow.
Yes, and he...
Was he like his dad? Do you know? I mean, just based on what you've read?
Let me give you this example.
Okay.
As we were traveling, we were doing a dedication on a painting at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and as part of that, George Patton was there, and he was a retired brigadier. He, in fact, said to me and my son, would you like to go through the museum and I'll talk about some of the artifacts that were sent, memorabilia from my dad's time and the family? And I said, certainly. So we're in the museum, and it was Saturday. And on Saturday, they have a lot of the trainees that were visiting the museum. And inside the museum is a life-size statue of George Patton of World War II. And it's colorized, and it looks like it's in a plexiglass case. George Patton, the son, was standing next to that with my son, and I looked against the wall, and there was a trainee there, and his eyes were as big as saucers looking at that, and I imagined what was going through his mind, so I walked over to him and introduced myself, and he said, that's impossible. I said, are you thinking that that's a reincarnation of George Patton World War II? I said, that's his son. Would you like to meet him? And
wow.
So I walked over to General Patton, and I said, sort of said, young trooper here, he's in armored training, he would like to meet you. So George went over there, and in typical style, he looked him right in the eyeball, and he was about a foot away from his face, and the young trooper, and he says, son, what are you doing here? I said, sir, I'm training to be a M1A1 Abrams gunner, sir. He said, what kind of gunner will you make the Army, son? Sort of the best damn gunner they've ever seen. Good answer. So that was
like father, like son, right?
That's right. And he was a great commander. But in my particular case, I was becoming very good at night operation with tanks, which was kind of unheard of in Vietnam. And George Patton liked that, so he moved me from the armor unit I was with, the tank unit, to a recon unit, which was a cavalry unit that was in the same squadron, was A Troop. And at that particular time, we didn't have a commander that was, I was the acting commander as a first lieutenant. And I was due to rotate out. And the mission that we had for our troop along Highway 13, which was adjacent to, parallel to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, was to escort and pick up the escort of convoy, supply convoy from Loc Ninh, basically Saigon, Loc Ninh, and all the way up Highway 13 through Lai K, to resupply the various bases along there. And it was an area of Highway 13 from Lai K on up that was to An Loc that was somewhat unsecure, and they had fire bases, temporary fire bases along those for protection, and I was in one of them. And the mission we had was to take one of my platoons of seven vehicles and send it to Lai K to pick up the convoy, and the other platoon go up to An Loc and refuel and then come back and be the ready reaction force in case the convoy was hit, which was being escorted by military police jeeps, gun jeeps, besides my troops we're talking about. Basically, supplies that included your 5,000-gallon tankers, your fuel tankers for your MoGas, gasoline, diesel fuel, aviation fuel, bullets, ammunition of other, explosives of sorts, supplies, food supplies. So we're talking about 125 trucks, basically. And we haven't had much of a problem in that area. And we had a new commander come on board just within days of this particular mission that we'd run usually about once a week. And they would supply about once a week. So I told him, I said, I was due to leave to be the squadron S2 intelligence officer. I knew the route. The platoon leader for that particular platoon had been injured the day before, and his platoon sergeant, we evacuated them, so they didn't have a platoon leader, platoon sergeant. I said, I'll run that route, and when I get back, then I'll back out of here, I'll air back out of here, and go back to the S2. So he agreed. And we hadn't had any problems along that route. We just had an occasional sniper round that was probably, as I ascertained, probably because it was near, it was right after Christmas, So I figured it was an NVA with a new AK-47, and he was trying to zero it. He wasn't a very good shot. So the plan after we went up to Ad Lock was to logger or set up for as a reactionary force for the convoy in case it was hit in a position where we'd been receiving some of the sniper fires. So I figured we'd capture this guy. If we capture him for intelligence purposes, we probably could get some good information on the NVA units that were close. And I radioed the convoy to go ahead and move out the escort. They were down in Lycay. We're talking about a distance of, it was probably about 36 to 40 kilometers distance from where I was to where they were. But where we decided to stop and logger off the road after we had passed going north, an NVA reinforced company had moved in to ambush the truck convoy. And there, once after the battle was ended and we got the prisoners and we got the intelligence, we found out that it was an NVA unit that was going to eliminate the convoy and then use that as a morale factor to build up the morale of the NVA troops and move back into Cambodia over the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
How many troops did the enemy have for that?
Well, they were a reinforced company, so they were doing about, they were running about almost 200 troops.
Wow. And how many were in your convoy?
Well, I had 7 vehicles and 28 men.
Oh, I think the odds were against you.
Well, it's they were after they hit us. They were because they were on the ground. So as we slowed down to move into the logger position, I was blown out of the vehicle, and I thought I hit a mine. And as I flipped back into the vehicle, I saw both my gunners had been killed. We'd been hit by the RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, recoilless rifles, and machine gun fire. And both my gunners have been killed. And then, and again, you know, going back to memorials, the one gunner, Charles Day, was a young fellow. Most of my troops were 17 to 19 years old.
Goodness.
And he had just shown me a picture of his baby, his young child that he was going home to see. Well, he was killed, so he never had the chance to see that child. That child never see the father. So again, that relates back to why memorials are so important in my mind. And I think that's why Steve works so hard on it, because he feels the same way. And even though Steve's not a vet, he's really dedicated to getting this done.
He sure is.
And so as we got hit, since we were on a road, that was probably, I'd estimate, probably 25 feet across, it was a dirt road. It was elevated. We didn't know that there was a depression on one side where the NVA troops were shooting up at us. And across the road, they were shooting straight at us, so we were in effective crossfire. We couldn't lower some of our guns that we could get on the vehicles, our weapons, because they wouldn't depress far enough for us to engage. So most of the vehicles were hit, they were on fire. We had wounded people, we had 28 people, most of them were wounded. There were 5 of us that were really able to carry on the fight. And so we tried to consolidate the wounded, move them in. I had people there that were supposed to go back that day to get ready to move from Vietnam back to the United States that volunteered to come with me. We had Don Larson, we gave him Wayne Tuttle, several others that decided to come with me because I was short people. They were there with me that day. And so we were in the midst of this, which was pretty close proximity to the enemy because they were so close to us. I mean, they were eyeball to eyeball. So you didn't have to worry about, out there 300 meters or 150 meters or 75 meters. I mean, they were like 3 meters away.
You could see your targets easily.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was a pretty tight situation, and we didn't have any radios because the radios were hit. We didn't know whether the call got out to stop the convoy or not, but it did. So we were fortunate enough to stop that convoy so they didn't run into the same ambush. Now, the NVA had no choice, because if we would have moved into that logger position, we would have discovered their ambush.
Can you explain what you mean by logger position?
Well, a logger position is where you pull the vehicles of the element you're in off of the main route in a circle position so that you're protecting your own element, but you're ready to go in case you have to react to in the case of this particular situation. If the convoy would have been ambushed, we could react to that and go down to the logger position. Is normally your temporary defensive position.
Okay.
Temporary. So that's what we're trying to do. And the NVA had to initiate the ambush. And when they did, they didn't realize that after the first 30 seconds, of any engagement are critical, because within the first 30 seconds, it's going to determine whether you survive or you don't. And we were able to survive. And the NVA didn't have plan B. They didn't have, even though we were there, they had us surrounded, they had us under heavy fire. They figured they'd kill all of us, but they didn't realize that we'd be able to withstand that. And so they tried ground assaults, and we were there. It was pretty tight.
How long did the battle last?
Well, we were hit about 10:31, and we didn't get a reaction force there until the afternoon, early afternoon.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
Was there any concern about running out of ammo?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say, the long battle, you didn't to spend that length of time fighting.
Yeah, it was a situation where we tried to pull as much as we could off the vehicles because some of them were firing at secondary explosions. And so we had some of that, but still, with the amount of firepower we're putting out with the weapons we had, we were burning barrels and we were using shovels when we had it, when they came close enough to us, and they tried to get over the top of us.
Well, wait a minute. You were using shovels. Yeah. What were you using shovels for, to hit them?
Yeah, defensive tools, right.
You're kidding. Yeah, yeah. That close a battle.
Yeah, they
that
were.
Was hand-to-hand combat, essentially.
Well, yeah, we had a chance to meet them face-to-face on several occasions. But then as we got near towards the expiration of our ammo, I knew I couldn't help the wounded get out and do an escape and evasion, E&E, because we were surrounded. I couldn't get them out. So we had them pretty well consolidated, and I told one of the sergeants that was there, I said, you know, there are five of us, and we'll try to hold them off you, but if they come over the top of us, you know, you're the only one that's with these wounded men that can make a decision on this. And I gave him two hand grenades. I said, do what you want with them, either protect yourself with them or do what you think is appropriate. And he knew what I meant. But just about that time, I looked down the road, and this was the dry season in Vietnam. It was a lot very dusty. I saw the antenna with a CAV flag on it. What had happened is the word that we'd been hit got out, and a guy by the name of Caldwell was a lieutenant with the tank platoon that was attached to us from the 2nd Squadron. And he heard that we'd been hit, so he got his tanks together and up the road. But they stopped about 150 yards from us, and I couldn't figure out why they stopped. But the reason they stopped was when they looked down the road, because of the dust and the intensity of the conflict and the closeness and proximity of the enemy, they couldn't tell who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. Mm. In other words, they were waiting to determine how to best maneuver into that without, you know, injuring or killing the friendlies as opposed to the enemy. So there's only one choice to do it. We still had no radios. So they couldn't communicate to us with a radio. We couldn't communicate to them. So I said to the sergeant that was there, and I said, yeah, there's only one way we can get them. I got to go down the road and get them. So I started down the road.
How fast can you run?
Real fast with
okay.
some shooting.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, so you had, and were they 150 yards, you say, from where you were?
Yeah, from where we were. And then as I got closer, the lead tank turned his main gun, a 90-millimeter main gun cannon, right at me. I mean, I was right there. I wasn't probably 60 yards away from it. And what I didn't know is behind me was an enemy rocket-propelled grenade or RPG team that was going to engage that lead tank. They were going to destroy that tank. And so the tank commander had to make a choice. There's one soldier coming at him that's friendly, perhaps. He still didn't know because I hadn't reached the tank. And here's an enemy sapper team that's trying to get this tank, so he had to engage it, and he did. And luckily, most of the round went over me, around me.
Yes, I would say luckily. That's a good way to describe
it. It kind of blew me in the bushes there.
Did it really?
Yeah, my ears are ringing, and so I couldn't climb out of the bush. And he got the sapper team, and I got to the lead tank, and they were able to. We were able to ascertain for them the best place for them to maneuver. So they maneuvered around, and we were able to turn the battle at that particular point in time. But then when we're getting ready to evacuate the wounded, the medevac helicopter with the red crosses on the helicopter indicating and it's an unarmed helicopter for medevac purposes landed, and an RPG team popped up on the other side of it, and it was running with the, you know, it was rotating. We were loading people on there, wounded soldiers on there. And I saw the RPG team, and one of my gunners in one of the vehicles had a gun operational. I pointed to him. I pointed to the RPG team, and he knew what I meant. I mean, it was still loud. It was just hand and arm signals. And he turned his gun on that RPG team, which was right underneath the tail boom of the operating helicopter. So it was a, one of these risky shots, you know, you can make sure the range is right on that thing. And he did, he shot and hit the RPG team, and they released the RPG. It went over the helicopter and detonated, not on the helicopter, but harmlessly on the terrain. So we were able to save the helicopter from being hit by the RPG team. And then they evacuated us to the hospital. I was the last one to go out, and when I got to the hospital, and I told Tuttle was evacuated with me, and we got to the hospital, and I said to Tuttle, I said, we need to get back to the battle, doing battlefield police, they're still engaging. So he, in fact, worked with me, and he said, how are we going to get out here? Because they cut all your clothes off because of our wounds. And I procured a Jeep, and he procured a couple of weapons and a couple of uniforms, and we did a what they call a DD mile back to the site. Now, it was a field line ambulance, so it's against the Geneva Convention to use that type of vehicle in combat. But if you cover the Red Crosses over with mud, it's no longer a field line ambulance. It's an assault Jeep, and that's what we so we got that. And so we got back to the site, and one of the troops found my lighter that my wife had given me, and had been hit by a bullet, and it was ahead of my chest pocket. So it saved my life.
Wow.
And then we got back to the fire support base, and I had a call bypassing my chain of command directly from the regimental commander, who was then Colonel Patton. And he called me, and my call sign was Bobcat 5. I was the XO. And he called directly to me on the company frequency and said he had gotten a report of two AWOL soldiers, stolen weapons, and a stolen Jeep. And he put two and two together and came up with me. And he said, I don't care what you do, but you get that stuff back to the hospital.
So, so what we're hearing is, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, a hero who was a thief.
Well, it was, what I did was, I was familiar with field expediency.
Oh, okay.
Field
right.
expediency.
Yeah. Jerry Brady, is have we passed the statute of limitation for Al?
We're long out of jurisdiction.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, I think you'd have to extradite him back to Vietnam for that matter. Some humor in a very unfortunate. I mean, I'm just enthralled by what you went through. If my math serves me correctly, it sounded like you said you started with 28 people.
Correct.
And at one point you were down to 5 fighting the enemy.
Correct.
And that didn't include the wounded.
We had the one. A lot of the wounded couldn't fight him.
Right. Exactly right. What was going through your mind? Did you have thoughts, this is the end, or did you just have no time to think about anything but killing the enemy and surviving?
Well, it wasn't as much killing the enemy, but, you know, bringing the troopers out of that, getting the troopers back, and you really don't have a lot of time to think about yourself in a situation like that. Because regardless of, you know, you have some men that may have more experience than you in a particular organization that you're with or the element you're with, but you're wearing leadership tabs. They're looking at you and they're saying, okay, Lieutenant, what's
it's
the next
step? It's up to you to survive them.
I had one of the wounded guys, Rodriguez. I looked down at him and the medic shook his head and said, Rodriguez, you know, just that's it. Rodriguez is gone. Rodriguez was just kind of gray. So I grabbed Rodriguez in the middle of this thing and he had a flak jacket on and I shook him. Just shook him, and something told me that he wasn't going to be gone. And he opened one eye, just partially opened one eye, and I knew that maybe we could bring him back. That's the middle of this thing, and I don't know why it happened, but I just had a feeling this guy, he wasn't going to die on me. I lost two of my troopers that got killed initially when he got hit, and here's another one, and I wasn't going to lose another one. And so he opened one eye, partially, and looked at me, and I said, George, I said, you know what we need right now? He kind of looked at me like, what the hell is he talking about? And all these bullets are flying and it's loud. And I was right up to his ear. And I don't know why I said it, but I said, George, we need an ice-cold Coca-Cola. And then he opened both his eyes, just as if to look at you and say, what the hell are you talking about? Are you nuts? And then he came back. And
did he survive?
He did. Years later, when I was at Department of Veterans Affairs, now that was 11 January 1969, fast forward to about 1997, my administrative assistant, Deborah Collier, said, sir, Mr. Fritz, there's somebody on the telephone for you. He said he served with you in Vietnam. So I picked up the phone. I said, "Hell, Fritz." And he said, "You don't know who this is." I said, "Pardon me." He said, "Yeah, I served with you in Vietnam." And I said, "Well, you're George Rodriguez."
Do you recognize
him? And he said, "How do you know?" So I explained the scenario to him. He says, "Yeah, that was me. How do you know?" He said, "I recognize your voice." And I did. I truly did. Just popped back in my head. So those things happen. And then for a moment, and I don't know, you talk about near-death experiences. I don't know if this is one or not. But for a moment during that firefight, I was kind of out of body. I was kind of looking at what was happening. The sound kind of deadened around me, just as if I had ear, you know, sound protectors on. And I looked up and I saw two bullets come by me with the tracers after the bullets. They seemed to be floating by me. And then mentally, I gyrated through a scenario where I saw myself as a very young person, a teenager, then adult, and then the Army, and then bang, I was back in the battle again. Everything happened. I'm back there I was. So I don't know why that happened. It did happen, you know, I was wounded, but it was just one of those strange things that happened to you. And we did a sweep at, we were doing a sweep, and I ran into a North Vietnamese in the sweep. We were in the bush, and I had a 45, and a 45 was a government-issued, government-issued 45. It was always dependable, never let me down. And all of a sudden, this great big NVA came through the bush, and I was down this depression.
Explain the acronym MVA.
North Vietnamese Army Regular.
Okay, thanks.
Trooper, a regular soldier that, and the unit we ran against had the same equipment that a well-equipped regular Army troop would have. I mean, they had the web gear, they had the rifles. Anyway, this guy came out, and we were just kind of nose to nose, and he was coming towards me. I had my 45, and I just had a perfect shot. I mean, he was right there. He was 3 feet away from me, and I just pulled down on him, and a good sight picture, and it just happened so fast. And that 45 for the last round did not lock back. It chambered on an empty chamber. So when I pulled that trigger, it was like somebody hitting the bell with a gong, and it just, boy, there it was. Man, and I couldn't do anything because he had his AK-47 with extended bayonet, and he was right there. I mean, then I looked down, and I remember looking down at his weapon, and he had a malfunction. Part of the round, instead of going to the chamber, was sticking out, the bullet part. and the rest of it was real fast, but ultimately, my troops told me I disarmed him and bayoneted him with his own bayonet. So then we took those two firearms back afterwards, and we ran four magazines through the 45 and a couple magazines through the AK-47, and there wasn't a malfunction on either one. Now, two malfunctions like that happening simultaneously in that situation, you got to say somebody's going to watch it over you. You know, it's not luck.
I don't know what your spiritual thoughts were before that, but did they change in any way, shape, or form after that firefight?
Well, I think afterwards, I gained even a greater appreciation for, you know, a greater power than anybody has on this earth that's looking over all of us, and that there's got to be, that power is guiding you, and that's the reason I was able to survive, because there was another mission for me to do, there were more missions for me to do, and to me, that was a message that came very, very clear to me. And two, the fact that, you know, life is so fragile and important that you've got to live it the best way you can for as long as you can, helping as many people as you can. And that's the way you got to walk that straight and narrow.
I was going to say, I think you just defined for all of us why you're committed to helping veterans.
Hmm. Well,
what you do, Hal, and what you continue to do since then is, you know, a dedication to a cause that I know so many veterans are most grateful for. Which brings me to, are you concerned about the care nationally that veterans are not receiving?
Yeah, I am. And having been in the VA system at the clinic here for 8.5 years, I believe that the issue can be resolved. You have more veterans coming into the system. When we moved from the Peoria Clinic downtown to the Peoria Clinic on Orange Prairie, which was a good move, and I worked to get the transportation out there, it was a good move, but they didn't increase the size of the staff, even though there was mentioned that the number of veterans would increase threefold from what we had in Peoria. So, and if you look at it right now, if you look at the VA across the board, you can start with the Peoria Clinic and work your way up. Unless you have the direct health care providers available, those that still stay on are going to be overwhelmed, totally overwhelmed. And we got to do a better job. The VA's got to do a better job of recruiting men and women that want to serve as health care providers, both your doctors, your nurses, your radiologists, so that we're able to meet the needs of the veterans so that they can fulfill their entitlements and their right to those entitlements. And the bureaucracy up there, you just take that middle management, and you could take that middle management and upper management and cut it at a third of what it is now and still be effective if you put that money down where it counts. I went to the President of the United States as the President of the Congressional Mental Water Society. That was Barack Obama. And I talked to the Secretary of VA, and I said, what you need to do is you come down to where the rubber meets the road, and you come to a clinic, and you sit down with the employees of that clinic with a non-attribution policy and say, if you were me, what would you do to improve health care in the VA? And then you'd get the answers. Because what happens is that's all filtered, and by the time it gets up to the Secretary of the VA, and it gets up to the Secretary of the Army, and DOD, and the President, everything's looking okay. We got a few shortfalls. But if you get down to where the rubber meets the road, and I didn't have either the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Secretary of VA, take me up on that offer. And I did. I went to Washington on five different occasions as the Congressional Mental Water Society President for the Veterans Day programs in Washington. So I had a chance one-on-one to talk to all of them. And none of them took me up on it. Why?
Yeah. That's one of the scandals of today's society, in my opinion, in government, is the way our veterans are being treated. I've said this before on the air, and I've said it in my column, is that I get all of these, and I contribute to most of them, all these letters from different organizations that are out to help veterans. Those organizations shouldn't be necessary. It's our government who should be taking. If we've got money to spend, and I won't get into certain areas of the government, for them, we've got money to spend on our veterans, and we're not doing it. Have you thought about writing a book? Because if you don't, I am from this interview, because people need to hear what you went through, as well as so many others in battle, not just in Vietnam, but every battle that this country has been involved in over the years. It's a compelling story, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in.